Greetings, programs, and welcome to the Awesome Friday podcast, the only podcast on the entirety of the internet that offers reviews of film and television. They're wholly unique. My name is Matthew, and I'm your host. With me is Simon, my perennial co-host. And we're going to talk to you today about some... Well, we're going to talk to each other about some movies, and you're going to listen, and it's going to be good. Or a movie and a TV show. But before we do that, how are you, Simon? How's things?
Good.
How's it going?
I'm amused that I'm perennial. I've only ever used that for plants. I'm trying to work out what plant I would be. talking of which, nothing grows in my garden. If anyone's listening, I know this isn't film or TV reviews, but if any of you can recommend ways to make completely barren land grow anything, please let us know in the comments. That would be lovely.
I mean, I can tell you that your garden being the space outside of your front door of your house, I can tell you the reason for that is that there's no sunlight there. So you need to cultivate things that can grow in the shade or within indirect sunlight.
So I'm not sure. So we have a lot of sunlight in the end of the day on the right-hand side of the garden.
Indirect sunlight, my friend, is what you need to look for in your plant choices.
Wow, I'll just move the garden. And the bigger problem is the soil is basically sand. When you dig into it, it's like this brown sand.
And well, the answer there is money. Spend some money, build yourself a plant bed and make sure it's on the sunny side. Either make sure it's on the sunny side of the yard or buy some plants, which are probably going to be like vines and shrubs that can thrive in indirect or limited sunlight.
There we are. You know, I feel like we've talked about all the movies now. We should shift into gardening advice. All right.
The problem with that is not a bad idea. That is not a bad idea. The problem is that I have just dispensed all of my gardening advice. So
I don't know. Yeah. Well, I'm fine to answer your much earlier question. I'm good. I as mentioned in our Patreon episode, I've been showing my kids some classic movies, from like the early 90s and 80s, 90s and 2000s movies, so they can have a good education of what real cinema was. And I'll be watching those. And what else did I do this week? Just working hard, just too much work. My job has shifted from writer to person who does Excel spreadsheets all the time. And that's fun. Apparently, Excel is a programming language. Who knew that? I'm sure you knew that.
I did know that. It is the most commonly used programming language.
There we go.
Because it has effectively zero barriers to entry.
Oh, I found some barriers to entry.
Well, I mean, no, but there's not like... The syntax is very basic. And you just need to know like how to point one cell at another. It's not like...
Yeah, that's true.
Like it's as programming languages go, it's fairly low barrier to entry.
But I'm okay.
But it is also not, and this is a true story, no matter what anyone will tell you, it is also not a database.
Excel is not a database?
No.
What stops it from being a database? This is going to get very dirty very quickly. Isn't it?
We do not have the time to go into it, but a database, it acts in a way like a database can, in terms of like relational... relationships between information, but it is not in and of itself a database. It is just a spreadsheet. Those are two different things.
All right. Wicked. Well, let's not deviate any more into gardening or database explanations. And I'm back to our films. Yeah. It's been a week of watching some good films. I still haven't seen Civil War. I'm probably going to catch Civil War when it comes out. On demand. So
I mean, I hope so. I hope you, if you were going to go see a film in cinemas, actually, I don't know what I recommend. There's so much coming out right now, but I would recommend seeing it on a big screen if you could, if you could find the time.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? But hey, how about you? What have you been up to this week?
Not much. Just working, watching Fallout, which is one of the two things we're going to talk about this week.
Have you started the Guardians of the Galaxy game yet? That's my question for you.
So, no. And the reason for that is that we started watching Fallout, the TV show, and it made me think, I really want to play Fallout again. And then I found my copy of Fallout 4 for PS4, and turns out it'll just install on my PS5, and now I'm playing Fallout 4.
And is it good, as you remember? Are you having a good time?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of game. Like, it's a lot, like, there's a lot of building and stuff. It's not, I don't think it's your cup of tea in terms of the amount of, like, you have to go find stuff to build stuff to, like, do the thing. But it is the kind of game that I thrive in. Like, there's a reason why I'm good at Factorio, and parts of this are, you know, base building, and I'm good at that kind of stuff.
So I just want to add some detail. Like, maybe you're listening to Matt say, I'm good at building and that kind of stuff, and maybe you don't quite grasp the enormity of what he's saying, because he's actually under-emphasizing this to the point where I put a couple of hundred hours into Minecraft when I was playing a lot of Minecraft. And thought, and I made this like House of Glass, and it was pretty great. And I was playing in survival, not creative. That's for cheats and weaklings. And so I was feeling pretty good until I went over to Matt's house years and years ago, before my son was born, I think. And Matt had only could only describe what Matt made in survival as Endor. And I don't mean like, oh, he made a few wooden shacks. It's like, oh, here's my tree, like, city that I built piece by piece by mining every piece of this. Would you like to ride the train? And then we sit on the train while it takes us from one end of the city to the other. And it takes 5 minutes for this train to go through. And
okay, this is inaccurate, so, and I'll tell you why.
Uh-huh.
The reason is it? The train that took 5 minutes went from the treetop city to the desert city that was based around the desert temple.
Where is that save now, because my kids would fucking love that. Where is that?
It's gone. It got in one of the Minecraft updates right around the time right after Microsoft bought Mojang, however you pronounce it. The save file got corrupted, and like a big cliff went like right through the middle of the base. Like it loaded, but like it was destroyed. Like the like one of the chunks rendered like 20 blocks higher for some reason. Like it was really weird.
Rome all over again.
Yeah.
Well, so when Matt says he's good at base building, like he's better than anyone you know at it.
This is a very niche reference that I don't think Simon will get, but it was basically the Minecraft version of the Doom of Valeria. So do with that information.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm sure somewhere does. It's you have specific skills for focusing on huge projects. You should have been like a project manager or something. I feel like you've missed, is that maybe effectively what you're doing now, but some kind of massive like organization of all these elements of different parts moving together.
I was a middle manager in a big company for a long time. And anyway. But other than that, no, I've just been, you know, we watched Fallout. There's another show that I started watching that I'm not allowed to talk about yet. A couple of new movies that we're not going to talk about. I watched Immaculate this week. Dune Part 2 came out on demand, so I rewatched that this week. Finally caught up with a movie I've been trying to watch for like a year called Late Night with the Devil. And then I revisited... actually, pretty much right after last week's podcast, I revisited two films that I haven't seen since the 90s. Jean de Florette and Manon des Sources, which are a pair of French films from the 80s that were filmed together. They're like a diptych, like part one, part two. Turns out they are just as beautiful as, like, I remember, all I really remember from watching the 90s being, like, you know, 14 or whatever at the time, was that Emmanuel Berthe. It was fucking gorgeous. Watching them as an adult, it turns out they're also just like super good movies. Like really, really beautifully shot, wonderfully acted character dramas. And I enjoyed every second of them. And there's a scene in the second one in Manon des Sources where the like an old man character played by Yves Montand is given devastating news, and it's one of the best like momentary pieces of like face acting I can remember seeing in recent memory. So yeah, those are both on Criterion. If you have the time, they are 100% worth your time. They were a huge deal in the 80s too. Like, Yves Montand and Daniel Auteuil, I think he pronounced his name, and Gérard Depardieu were like the three biggest actors at the time. The guy who directed them, whose name is, don't tell me it'll come to me, shit. Claude Berry was a huge director at the time. They cost a ton of money. It took them like 10 months to film them because he wanted to like show the different seasons in the film because they take place over a long period of time. And but it turns out they're great. And Auteuil, I think that's how you pronounce his name, won a César and a BAFTA for it. Like, they were big deal movies in the 80s. And they are well worth your time.
Wow. That's quite a week you've had there. And I'm also impressed that you've discovered the ability to not sleep for a week, because that's the only explanation for fitting all that stuff in and a full-time job as well.
So I mean, I have a simpler explanation, and it's that I do not have children and I work from home.
Yeah, but you do have a wife. I mean, does she watch all this stuff with you, or do you like...
Most of it. Most wow. of it. She didn't watch the French ones with me. I watched those when she was in bed. But like Late Night with the Devil, Dune Part 2, Immaculate, we watched together. We watched all of Fallout together. Yeah.
Okay, give me one word review for these movies. Immaculate.
That's not possible.
One word adjective for Immaculate.
I mean,
come on, you can do it.
Good. It's good.
Okay, great. Late Night with the Devil?
Brutal. Great. Brutal.
I can't watch that. And how about a Dune rewatch, Dune Part 2 rewatch? Does it open up for you anymore?
It didn't this time. But I already liked it quite a lot. So I don't think I have to have the same... If you listened to the show before, you know that my journey with Dune was like... Part one was very like, oh, this is kind of cold and I don't really get it. And then over time, I very much started to get it. And I feel like I already got it going into Dune Part 2.
Right.
And also, Dune Part 2 is where literally all the interesting stuff in the story happens. And you don't need any of the setup because you've already had it in Dune Part 1. So there you go.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay, so what are we talking about this week then?
Right, so we're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about a TV show and a movie, the first of which is a TV show, and it is called Fallout. And why don't you give us the rundown on Fallout, which is based on the beloved video game franchise and starring Ella Purnell and Walton Goggins and Kyle MacLachlan and like a host of other people.
Yeah, I had the cast because I always forget names. So yeah, it's pretty. If you've played the games before, particularly Fallout 3 and 4 is one of the main sort of inspirations for the story beats and the look of this. But it follows the same kind of idea of the games where you've got someone in a vault. And this vault has been sealed away from the world for a couple of hundred years to protect the best and brightest of humanity, with the idea that they all work together for the betterment of the future. And one day they'll go back up to the surface and repopulate the Earth. So the nice thing about Fallout is that because it's like a time capsule of when the bombs go off and they go into the vaults, it's like a retro future 1940s. So there's lots of technology that didn't exist, like robotics and like personal wearable computers and things. But their language and the costume, the things they wear are of that time. And because the vaults went in at that time and their language doesn't really evolve in the hundreds of years they're in, they're down through generations. So there's very convivial, very polite, stuck in this 1940s framing of interior design and sort of hair and makeup and the way people greet each other. And it's always one of the nice things I think that Fallout did really, really well, is that kind of approach to this retro futurism. And of course, like all the games, you have a lone protagonist who decides, for whatever reason, to get out of the vault and go into the wasteland. And so you always have that beautiful moment of emerging into this bright, radioactive, and brutal world where everything is trying to kill you. And then basically the rest of the game is you as the character, or Lucy in Fallout, who is our character insert, trying to survive. Learning about the horrors, but also that the whole world is wrapped in layers of mystery, wrapped in further layers of mystery, and you speak to people who have, it turns out there have been people topside for hundreds of years too, so you try and stay alive while learning about their stories and doing things for people whilst learning about the truth behind everything, and there's always some kind of sinister corporate conspiracy to be uncovered, and there's like the groups like the Brotherhood of Steel, who are this like fascist, a militaristic American group who has very cult-like religion at the base of this like military group, who have this huge sets of power armor that you've got to navigate as well. So basically, it's a whole bunch of tribes and monsters that are trying to kill you. And in the TV show, Lucy has a thing to do, which is established in the first episode. And in trying to do that thing, she meets various people and discovers, shock, the people that she thought were good were maybe not so good, and the people she thought were bad were maybe not so bad. And anything more than that would be a spoiler, really. It's got a triple focused narrative of her and Walton Goggins, the character, which is my favorite part of the show, because I mean, he's fantastic, which helps, but I kind of like the characters who were really good and then had a reason to go really bad and are using that badness to try and do the things they've always wanted to do anyway. And then the third kind of focus is this young trainee in the Brotherhood of Steel, this religious, cultish military group. And they all basically learn about the truth of their environment and who's kind of pulling the strings, really. So it's if you've seen Westworld season one, it's basically the same story beats as Westworld season one, but the design of the show is fantastic. A lot of that is because the design of the games was so visually distinct, and I really hope whoever designed way back the first Fallout, because it was there right in that first isometric game, that design language was there, and I hope whoever was involved in that design got some kind of financial credit for this show, because it really leans on it and it does it really, really well. Like, it's the production design is very, very high, the acting is very, very good, Ella Purnell's fantastic, Walton Goggins is outstanding, supporting cast are all good, but just very familiar, and I just thought it was fine. I'm interested to hear your take, actually. What do you think?
It's actually not that far off, really. So, I've been struggling thinking about this, because I do actually, I even look back, I log what I watched TV-wise on Serialized, and I did actually really like a lot of the episodes. A couple of them are just, one of them in particular, I was like, do I want to keep watching this? But for me, it's not so much that the story beats are familiar, it's that, maybe it is, I don't know, it's just that, like, the structure of it is so familiar at this point, that, like, all does the same sort of thing that all the prestige shows do, which has been happening basically since Lost, which is that every episode asks a question, and not every episode answers a question. And I think what it really boils down to is you have to sort of accept that. I think why I liked it as much as I did, I should say, is that the main character of the Fallout franchise is the Wasteland, right? Not the characters, but the Wasteland itself. The end result of hyper-capitalism is sort of the main thing you play Fallout for, almost. And I think they've done a really, 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 really great job of capturing not just the aesthetics, but the whole vibe of the Wasteland and what the end of hypercapitalism would look like. And again, that like 1940s retro future aesthetic, like I find it fascinating that like in the alternate universe that Fallout takes place in. And to be clear, I think it's really cool that the show takes place in the same universe as all of the games. Like it is it's one big canon universe. And like, you know, Fallout 4 takes place in the 2270s, 2277, like 200 years after the bombs drop. And Fallout, the series, takes place in 2297 to 98, if memory serves. 96 and 97. And I find that really fascinating, and I find it all very, like, it's interesting that it can all just flow together, and the reason it can do that is because the setting is the main character, right? Like, the setting is the main thing, so... One of the greatest advantages the show has over other things that have been adapted from video games is they're not trying to adapt a story. They're just trying to set a story in the world. In that way, I feel like it has been very, very, very successful. Mm-hmm. And I find it fascinating that in the alternate history of Fallout, like, it's super interesting that, like, America dropped a bomb and then nuclear power became, like, the default energy generation method. And, they developed things like gene splicing, but not like microprocessors. Like everything is vacuum tubes and analog electronics. And I find it all very fascinating. And to be clear, they definitely have circuitry as well, but like there's vacuum tubes all over the place. And I dig that. I think my biggest problem with the show is that I found the finale, which I'm not going to spoil, but I found the finale to be kind of disappointing. And not that it was poorly acted, but it was too many new questions for next season and not enough answers from this one. I wish it was a little more self-contained, basically. I feel like the answers, some of the answers to some of the questions were kind of unsatisfying. And some of them you could just see coming from a mile away. So I think your mention of it being just a little too familiar is probably pretty nail on the head, really. And not just this was made by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, who very successfully made Westworld. But it's not just Westworld. It's like, it's sort of the prestige TV formula, and it's probably one of the best adapted video game type shows to date. But it also just doesn't really do anything all that new. And I know that's kind of a big ask. But I kind of just wish it was a little bit less standard, and in particular I feel like it needed to be funnier, like, because at its core Fallout is a satire, and the humor in the games is black as hell, and I feel like the show definitely has moments of it where funny shit happens and stuff you laugh at and you're like, oh god, I can't believe I laughed at that. And I just feel like there wasn't enough of it. I feel like it doesn't lean into the inherent, like, absurdity of... Like, there's a level of... Yeah, absurdity is probably the right word. There's a level of that the universe sort of requires that they don't lean heavily enough into. They lean far more in the direction of, like, of drama than comedy. And I feel like that balance is off. I feel like the show would be better if it was funnier, especially if you have a guy like Walton Goggins playing the main role. Like, not, and a lot of it would be true. A lot of this wouldn't be a complaint if some of his lines were delivered a little bit differently. You know, not everything. He's probably the funniest part of the show, but it's all said with such seriousness that, well, seriousness is maybe the wrong word, but I think, I don't know. Do you know what I'm getting at here? That, like, it needs to be a little bit funnier, basically, is the shortest version of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, there's two funny moments, and actually there's a comedic actor who has a very small part in this, and because he is so good at comedic delivery, and you'll know as soon as you... I won't tell you who it is, so I don't spoil it, but he's a very distinct way of delivering, and he kind of doesn't really fit in to the tone of everything around him, because he's doing his best to kind of be a little bit irreverent. And I think the whole tone of the show could have taken that lead a bit more. In the final episode, which I agree is not a satisfying conclusion, it's just an exposition dump of things that you probably were guessing, and then a ton of new things. Is that you're absolutely right, it's that lost structure, it's that, and by connection with almost the same exact characters finding out it's the Westworld structure too. But there's one very funny moment in the finale with autonomous vehicle going the wrong way that made me laugh. Was the only time I laughed out loud in the whole like 8 hours of the show, the first time I laughed out loud. I was like, oh, that would have been nice to have a bit more of that, because there's so much, as the games show you, there's so much potential for humor in Fallout, and there is a lot of humor in Fallout. And yeah, I think for me, the episodes are too long. There's too much filler. There's episodes you could cut out. I wasn't personally interested in one of the three storylines at all. Like, I kind of was winning it over the Brotherhood of Steel storyline. I don't think added anything at all. And
this is actually pretty emblematic. Yeah, that's the wrong word, but it's pretty on the nose for my problem with it, is that, like, I feel like, so it's an 8-episode show, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, like, the Brotherhood of Steel guy, Maximus, or the main character, Lucy, end up in this sort of, like, romance, but it feels like the whole show, the whole 8 episodes, builds towards this moment where, like, you just know that they're going to have a moment of happiness, and then their relationship is going to be, you know, cleft in twain, and they're going to go different ways, and they're going to end up in conflict in season 2. And I don't think saying that is a spoiler, because that is just how so many fucking shows have done it, you know, like, and so many movies have treated their, like, act 1 to act 3 progression that, like, it's very, I think, honestly, I hate to say it, but I think you probably could have removed Maximus, and it probably would have made the show at least more focused. Like, I kind of wish that the structure of the show was that, like, Lucy, that Ella Purnell and Walton Goggins meet early on and then go on their quest together, which is a little more straightforward, to be fair, but also, like, there's so much more potential for, like, you know, basically the buddy cop formula, like, mismatched partners going on an adventure and meet a bunch of zany characters along the way. I think that would have been a more enjoyable show for me. But having them be separate for most of the runtime and only, like, interacting with each other off and on kind of detracts from the show. And the show does also take place in 2 time frames. And that's honestly, like, that's fine. I actually like that part. Like, there's a whole bunch of explanations of stuff that's happening in the present that, if you played the games, you probably already know, or at least have an idea about. But to see some of that stuff dramatized was really interesting. And to see the world on screen, you know, pre bombs dropping, was also really interesting, because you don't really get a lot of that in the games. So it was interesting to see how exactly the world worked in those moments. And just to circle back to the person I believe you're speaking about, who is the voice of a robot, right? I do feel like if there was more of that sort of tone, it would have also been better. Like, definitely, because, like, the robot is still, I laughed out loud at the robot a lot. And he's in a couple of episodes, and then the actor himself shows up for an episode and makes a pretty blatant comment on, like, late stage capitalism, which I thought was very on the nose, but in a good way. And I don't know, I feel like, I'm not trying to say it's bad, I'm just trying to say that, like, it's good, it's not amazing. It's, some of the episodes are great. Like, I think that the first episode in particular is great.
So I have a problem with the first episode. Like, there's one thing that I think it did completely wrong in terms of trying to capture the game. And I've been really curious to hear whether you agree or not as I watch the whole thing.
No, hit me with it.
So we got 3 split storylines. You got Lucy's, you got Maximus's, and you've got Coop's. So you've got the roaming man with a gun. You've got the Brotherhood of Steel guy learning about Brotherhood of Steel, and you've got Lucy in the vault. And so the first chunk of the episode starts with Lucy in the vault. And one of my absolute favorite parts of every single Fallout game I've played is because you always start in the vault and you start in the safety of the vault. It's that moment when you choose or are forced to go outside and the gate opens and you walk into that space, you know, that wasteland character for the first time is fundamental to Fallout to me. And in the first episode, because they were doing three storylines, they cut to Maximus in the wasteland, in the Brotherhood of Steel, before Lucy had left the vault. And that really was, I think they got that completely wrong, because that Lucy, the vault dweller emerging from the vault into, you know, the hero goes into the unknown and steps beyond the boundary. That's a really important part of Fallout to me. And by seeing the outside with Maximus' story before we see it through Lucy's eyes, I thought really diluted it.
I mean, this sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier, that, like, I think if it had been the Lucy show, the Lucy and Walton and Cooper show, I think it might have been a better show. Because you just, you know, you spend the first episode or two-thirds of an episode building up towards Lucy having to leave, and then Lucy leaving. Like, maybe the first episode ends with her entering the wasteland. And I feel like the split structure, and it's interesting because, again, I don't actually really feel this way about the flashbacks to the quote to the pre-war stuff. But having the split structure, I think it does detract from it a little bit. It loses a focus that I feel might have been beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's also hard, like I say this, but also the guy who plays Maximus, I thought was actually pretty great. I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Aaron Clifton Moten.
Yeah, I think he's great. I think he's really, really good. He does really interesting things with that sort of, like, and in a very complimentary way to, like, both he and Lucy have grown up in different cults, and their reactions to the way the world works and to each other are very interesting and complimentary, and I think actually really well performed. Like, none of this is anyone who's acting in the show's fault at all.
No.
And I will say that I did appreciate there's also, you know, basically a fourth storyline where Lucy's brother back in the vault is, like, figuring out the vault, and all of that comes to a head at the same time as, like, realizations happen in the surface as well. And I thought that was actually really well executed as well. And Moses Arias, I thought, was really, really, really good as the, like, the smart one in the vault, and the sort of shrewd one in the vault might be a better word for it. So it's I know it sounds like I'm just complaining about the show, but it's just like so close to great. You know what I mean? Like, it's frustratingly close to great for me. And I liked a lot of the episodes a lot, but between the ones that I didn't and the unsatisfying conclusion, it's just good. It's good. It's good, not great, is the shortest version of my review. It's good, not great.
Yeah, I've seen that show before. Almost exactly the same characters learning exactly the same things from the same people. And I would have, like you, I would have liked to have seen it cut down by a third in terms of the storyline split, and just maybe try a different, a lighter approach, different kind of structure than we've seen before. But yeah, but it's got a second season, so it's clearly doing something right.
Yeah, I mean, there's an irony there in that a show that is so pointedly commenting on late stage capitalism is being funded by Amazon. but that's both ironic, but also, like, I'm pretty sure Amazon will, as with Vault Tech, will monetize whatever they can. You know, like, that's definitely a thing. It's also, like, this show is a who's who of just, like, character actors showing up for, like, one scene. One of whom I was very disappointed to see, but all the rest of them, I was like, holy shit, that's Dale Dickey. Like, holy shit, that is Neil Huff. Holy shit, that's Chris Parnell. You know, like, there's so many people in it. Fred Armisen shows up for like, he has a couple of vocal cameos on the radio, and then they go to the radio station. He's in one scene and then he's gone. Mm-hmm. And like so mm-hmm. many times like that. And I really sort of appreciate that. I mean, I know that at the same time, those kinds of cameos are taking away from some young actor having their first on-screen bit, but it's also like, it's just fun to see that so many people were drawn to the story and that Amazon mm-hmm. was willing to spend the money to get them. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I feel like it has lots of promise for season two, and I hope that I enjoy it better. But if we're going to make the comparison to Westworld season one was something that as soon as it was over, I wanted to watch it again. And I don't feel that way about this.
Yes. But only, I mean, I feel the same, but only, I loved Westworld season one, which is why I'm pretty cold about this, because I've seen this before. And I think I think there's huge potential to tell really good stories with the people they've got and the production design they've got. And I would love them to be a bit more brave and not just following that template, because I don't want to see Westworld again. And Westworld season two actually bounced off completely because it went really, really like contrived into all the layers of, like, every episode was a couple of answers and new questions, and the mystery gets deeper and deeper. And I think it really kind of, it lost way more focus than the first one. So I hope Fallout doesn't go down the same trap, really.
I mean, as much as I am excited, as much as I am saying that it's fine, I'm also excited to see more. I do kind of wonder, the show is really well, again, really well acted. I do like the characters, but I almost wonder if approaching it from a more anthology angle might have been better, where like maybe you do like a 10 episode season and it's one complete story, and then you do another 10 episode season and it's another story from another vault, just like the games, right? Like everyone tells a different story, but in a connected universe, and perhaps and potentially in a different part of North America. Because like every Fallout game, they're all thematically connected. The only ones that direct sequel to any of the other ones is 2 to 1, in that you play a descendant of the Vault Dweller. In 2, you play a descendant of the Vault Dweller from 1. But like 3 and 4 take place in, and New Vegas take place in, completely different parts of the country. Like the stories themselves are not connected. And I kind of wonder if maybe a more anthology approach might have been better.
Maybe. So are you starring this as a season? What are you going to give it?
Overall? I mean, I've seen all of it. I think it's just barely not a 4 for me. Like, it's a 3. It's a 3 out of 5. And like, I think if, and I'm going to put a caveat on that, in that I think that if the finale had been more satisfying, it would be a 4. Because I did generally, like, I'm just looking back at my logs, and like, I rated more of the episodes. They're all 3 or 4, and more of them are 4 than 3. But I found the finale to be so much, so out of balance with what I wanted it to be. I don't know if it's fair to say what it needed to be, but what I needed it to be, that it kind of soured me on the whole season a little bit, which is disappointing. But again, it's still great. I mean, and if you watch it right now, you get to see it without ads because Amazon sucks. I don't know. Where did you come down on this? I'm guessing.
I liked it less. Yeah, I liked it less than you. It's a 3-star, but it's just a 3-star. Mm-hmm. I thought the acting was great. Walton Goggins especially was fantastic. The production design is fantastic. And they use lots of real outdoor environments to capture.
Lots of practical effects too. I am desperate to know, and I've tried to find, but it's so hard to Google anything about it. But I am desperate to know, like, what the percentage of practical to digital, the power armor is, in terms of effects.
Yeah,
because they clearly built power armor, right? Like, they clearly built it.
So there's a couple of moments where the telltale with CG is they get gravity, they get weight wrong quite often, so you can see the weight of things is wrong. But when that thing is moving through space, and it's either one of the best bits of practical armor I've ever seen, or the person who lit that should get a raise, because the lighting of CG to make it fit into the environment is like the key, and it is it's either spectacularly made or spectacularly lit CG. So either way, good job to whoever did that. Because like you, I have no idea. And I think that shows you that the CG was entirely successful. Because when you can't tell, that's the job of CG, isn't it? But it just looks...
It's yeah, and like the Mr. Handy robot is, I mean, clearly has to be at least partly CG because there's a rocket engine on the bottom of it. But like, it feels like they definitely went the extra mile to make as much of this, as much of the tech practical as possible. And I would just love to know, basically, like, you know, when you see on YouTube, see those scenes of like where they do a VFX breakdown and it like shows you a scene and then like a grid goes over it and they reveal what CG, like, I want to see that reel for this show.
Definitely.
I don't know that we'll get it, but I want to see that reel for the show.
Yes. Okay, so both three, but a couple of different threes there. But yeah, watch it. It's fine. It's totally fine. If you haven't seen Westworld, you might like it, actually. You might like it more than I do.
I mean, it's worth even pointing out that giving it threes, we seem to be very much in the minority. Like, the reviews have been very positive overall.
In terms of video game adaptations, it's much, much better than most other video game adaptations. So,
I mean, with them not having to adapt or choosing not to adapt an actual video game story and telling their own story in this universe, I think that gives them a lot of freedom. And I just maybe wish they took a little more of it.
Yeah. So before we move on to our next movie, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you buy the screen accurate Pip-Boy?
I booked a tattoo, so no. I booked a tattoo a little bit before I started watching Fallout and found out that Pip-Boy exists. And honestly, if that Pip-Boy did a little more in terms of like being a connected accessory to maybe my phone, I think it would have been a much harder thing to resist. But as it is, I booked a tattoo appointment that's going to cost me roughly five times more money than that Pip-Boy. So I have not purchased anything else recently.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, though. Actually, I've always regretted not getting the Fallout 4 special edition that came with the Pip-Boy. I've always regretted not having that. Honestly, the Pip-Boy is maybe the coolest video game tech ever, in my opinion. And I want one, and I don't want one that is just put your phone in a holder. I want one that is like a separate connected device. Like, basically, I want my Apple Watch to be a Pip-Boy. That's what I want. Ultimately,
I'm sure. I'm sure someone's working on that somewhere.
Probably.
Well, let's move on to our second thing today, which is a movie by a Cronenberg child. I forget her first name.
Caitlin. Her name is Caitlin.
And please tell us about Humane.
Rightio. So Humane is a new horror film from Caitlin Cronenberg. Starring a number of Canadian people, including J. Barrick Hill and Emily Hampshire and Sebastian Chacon and Enrico Colantoni, Peter Gallagher. It takes place in a near future version of effectively our world, where the global environment has finally collapsed after years of, you know, corporate pollution and all this kind of stuff. And it turns out that the solution is that 20% of people need to die in order for humanity to be able to continue on Earth, to stop the drain on resources, to allow for enough for the people who remain to live lives, basically. So the government... in the country they're in, and it's never explicitly stated what country they're in, but it's either Canada or America, has enacted a program where someone can enlist and to be euthanized. And the setup for this show is that a retired newsman played by Peter Gallagher invite his wife invite their adult children over and announce that they have enlisted. And then his wife bails at the last second. And when the government operatives led by Enrico Colantoni show up and euthanize him, they then turn around and say, okay, we're here for two bodies. You guys need to sort this out. And all the kids are like, no, but she left. And he's like, yeah, I know, but I need a second body. So you work that out amongst yourselves. I'll be outside. And that's the whole movie. That's the whole setup, which I think is a brilliant setup, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. I generally speaking, I really like this movie. I feel like if it's going to be held back by anything, it's that I think it's topical. I think it's timely. I think it has a lot to say about the way corporations have destroyed the world. I think it has a lot to say about how the super rich are effectively exempt from laws and consequences, or normally would be, because this is a rich family being forced to endure consequences for potentially the first time. I think if anything hurts it, it's that this is a fairly common theme at the moment, and it's not, there's nothing really new about the approach. If you've seen things Follow the House of Usher, or Ready or Not would be another good one, where they're all stuck in a house trying to kill one another. You've sort of seen the main beats of this story before. But it's wonderfully cast and funny when it needs to be, and dark as hell when it needs to be, and generally very well shot. And I generally enjoyed it, except, I'm sort of curious, and it's difficult to talk about without spoilers, but the last thing that happens in the movie, there's the very last thing that happens in the movie kind of undermines my entire feeling about it. There's an opportunity for things to be left. How to talk about this? There's a final scene, and then the credits roll, and then there's a final scene, and that final scene diminishes the film for me, where it makes some things that were about to be left up to my imagination explicit. And the answer is less satisfying than anything I might have imagined, basically. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I think that everyone in it is great. I think Enrico Colantoni is one of those guys who every time he shows up, I'm like, this guy is the best thing in whatever he's doing. He steals every scene that he's in. He's got this wonderful energy, especially in this movie, where he's like, okay, one of you needs to die. He's got a very upbeat demeanor about this dark as hell thing. He really understands the assignment. And I think that Jay Baruchel is continuing his streak, at least of things I've seen him in, of being actually a hell of an actor. He was great in Blackberry, and he's really good in this too. He's really, really good as the really entitled rich guy who's advocating for people to die whilst simultaneously being like, I'm not going to die, and no, neither to anyone in my family. I'm rich. We're exempt from this, right? Is basically his whole character. And he does a really good job with, honestly, not that much beyond that. I don't know. I liked it. I don't think I quite loved it because of the last thing, but I very generally liked it a lot. How did you feel about it?
Quite similar to you, actually. I thought the setup was really good. I do rich people having to face consequences for the first time is a great setup, and I really enjoy that. And House of Usher did it very, very well. It's very similar to the House of Usher in many ways. I was really impressed with Jay Baruchel. For someone who I only really knew as a comedic actor before Blackberry. And then I saw him in Blackberry thinking that it was a weird choice for a more straight film. And he was so good in Blackberry. And I think he's really good in this as well. So I'm really enjoying seeing someone who I thought only did loose-limbed comedy stuff and squeaky voice comedy stuff to have a real firm handle on playing an asshole as well. And I thought he was great. And the guy you were talking about, who I only knew from Flashpoint, Enrico Colantoni, and then I saw him in Station 11 and thought he was great in that. And this continues to be a bit of a wake-up call to me about how good he is
Do yourself a favor and remind yourself that he is in Galaxy Quest, and he is amazing.
I've just seen that as well. I had no idea that was him.
But also, just shoot me and like tons of TV. He's the dad on Veronica Mars. He's in so much.
I never saw. I'm a bad Canadian because I've never seen Veronica Mars. I've never seen iZombie. So I'm sure he's great in those two. But he's really good in this, and he's got a nice progression of character, because it turns out he's not really the government. He's a private contractor, basically a group of collectors who have to meet their quota. And again, there's a lot of capitalist comment in this, and he's going to make his quota. However he makes his quota, he's going to make his quota. And I thought he was interesting, but the problem with establishing a setup like that is that you need to kind of have a slide as people slowly degenerate, right? And you've got to have the steps towards absolute carnage. And I don't think this film really got that right. It tends to jump around. It's a little bit messy in the middle, and how people start reacting to each other and where allegiances are. And it didn't feel very satisfying to see people turn on each other so quickly, without any kind of second or third thoughts about it. And then they kind of have a moment towards the end where they kind of all voice their regret of the situation, and it doesn't feel earned. I don't know. I just thought it was a bit messy. And you've got Enrico Colantoni's very threatening aura from outside, and he does a really interesting job of being so kind of well-spoken and soft, but also extremely dangerous, especially around to the younger member of the cast, who will stand out for me. Sorry, I don't have her name to hand, but the young girl, Serena Galungas? Anyway, she's one to watch. She's got great intensity. I have seen her in stuff, and I have no idea what it was, but she is really, really good. But I thought it was just a bit unsatisfying, and I'm with you. The ending, I think, tried to do what Death on the Maiden does, but where Death on the Maiden leaves still requires you to work out what happened. This movie explicitly tells you what happened at the end. It completely underlines exactly how the movie ended, and I think if it had ended before that last scene, in fact, there's a cutaway shot, which I was convinced they were ending on, that I thought was actually a really good, clever ending, because it forces you to decide what's the end of this film. Like, which way did this film go? Yep. This film doesn't need you to do that, because it tells you explicitly, like very quickly after that scene. Which it does take away the satisfaction of it, and it doesn't have that. If you know Death and the Maiden, it doesn't have that kind of terrifying ending where you can't work out who hurt who the most. Right? And I think that's pretty integral when you've got an arc of characters who are learning to be brutal to survive, even to their own kin. And what the lengths you go to, it tells you explicitly the lengths they went to. And that is less satisfying. So it was fine. I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity to have a more meaty middle, as we have more allegiances and more breaches and more double crossing and a little less straight to violence. They picked on one of the rest of the brothers and sisters pick on one of the family members pretty quickly as a focus. And I would have enjoyed a bit more patient script in that section.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with you on most of that. I will say the one sort of point that didn't bother me, at least, was that they all sort of turn on each other right away. And you're right that it's not, like, it is very quick, but it also, like, in the movie, one of the characters is like, I don't actually fucking know you people. And, like, it's explained away in a way that I found to be fine, right? Like, there's not a lot of, like, but you're my brother. Like, one of the characters is like, we don't see each other, we don't talk. Like, I don't fucking care. Like you're not real people to me. and I felt that was, like, you know, coming from a larger family, I feel like that was maybe somewhat accurate. It's also tough because, like, on the one hand, you're right, it would be, I think, adding more to the middle, like adding more to that section of the film, has the potential would have the potential payoff to make a more meaty screenplay with, and maybe do a better job with some of what it's trying to say. But this film is also 90 minutes long, and I feel like adding anything to it also runs the pretty extreme risk of wearing it its welcome pretty quickly. You know, like, so it's sort of a double-edged sword, if you ask me. I don't know what the answer is. I feel like having seen the film, knowing what I know about how it's written, I feel like adding to it probably would have been a mistake. I feel like we have been talking about the opposite thing. I think we would be talking about how, like, it dragged in the middle, about how, like, it got bogged down in the family stuff in a way that was unsatisfying, is sort of my impression based on the writing. But I mean, yeah, you're also not wrong exactly. Like, this is, it's difficult. It's a difficult one to sort of parse in that structurally in that way. And I just, like, I think it speeds through some of its points. Like, there's one sort of great exchange where, someone is given the opportunity to back out. And when he realizes that the consequences to backing out, what the consequences are the reasons that he doesn't. And I don't want to spoil it for you, but, like, they are not that big of a deal. You know, like, they're not a big deal, but they're also not, like, they're not like somebody has to die in your place, right? It's not like, he's not signing on moral grounds, is what I'll say. He's signing for other reasons. And I think that, like, there's scenes like that that I think maybe could have used a little more weight, you know? But ultimately, at the same time, if this is Caitlin Cronenberg's first feature film, as with Monkey Man a week or two ago, holy shit, can't wait to see more. You know, like, it's not a bad
movie. No, not
too. But also, holy shit, can't wait to see more. Mm-hmm. And I am just glad that, like, this is a Canadian production, and I'm glad we're highlighting it. I'm glad I watched it, and I can't wait to see more. And I think that, probably speaking, the general reaction will probably be a little more effusive. I really like it. I don't know about you, but I'm sort of in the same place as this that I was with Fallout, in that, like, I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5. And with a few minor tweaks, it might have been a 4. Like, it's pretty close to being a 4. It's not, but it could have been, you know, what might have been, you know, but it's not, it's a 3. It's good. It's solidly good. And I recommend, that everyone watch it and form your own opinion, as I always do.
Yeah, it's probably a 3 for me as well. I enjoyed it, and there's lots of things that were, it's very well made. I think she shoots really well, it's well edited, so all the technical side is good, and it looks good as well. I'm not talking about extending the middle, I think just rewriting the script in the middle, so there's a bit of a more interesting journey to them trying to kill each other, or kill one person. Because there is, as much as they say, I don't know you people, and we're not close, there is also a move from some of them to try and build the closeness, that they do want to be closer brothers and sisters. And I think that would be more interesting to see where that goes. But yeah, it's a 3. It's a 3 for me. It's good. So some really standout actors in there, and some very creepy moments. There's lots of threat in there as well. But yeah, it could have. Maybe don't watch. You'll know when the movie should have ended. Maybe turn off there.
Yeah.
or maybe pause and allow yourself that satisfaction of trying to work out from what you watched what you think happened, and then watch the last scene. Maybe.
Yeah, and that's sort of it, right? In that, like, I think the difference between us here is that I was pretty, until the last scene, I was pretty willing to be like, this isn't perfect, but I had a great time. And, but then the last scene, I was like, really? Like, really? Like, you had to, you couldn't just leave it up to me. You know, this is like, this is not the best comparison, but it's like if Christopher Nolan had shown you what happened with the top at the end of Inception. it would be completely unsatisfying and kind of miss the point to show you what happens. And this film, in its very last scene, although it does feature a great vocal cameo from David Cronenberg, it shows you exactly what it's trying to say. And yeah, David Cronenberg plays the like news announcer guy who like there's these TV bits interspersed through the story where it's like your enlistees of the moment are these people, and they gave up their lives to protect their family. Like that voice on the TV is David Cronenberg. I feel like just omitting that one last scene would have made the whole thing like it all pretty much would have guaranteed it a 4-star review, and I'd have been like, you know what, it's not perfect, but I had a great time. It's a great first effort, but then it did this thing, and it's still good, it's just not great as a result.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
what's so I think I've got a big problem with Nepo Babies, but I think that aside, I thought this was really, really well made, and I'm excited to see what she comes up with next. I feel like she's got a distinct voice, at least. What's Brandon Cronenberg's films like in terms of technical quality and
oh, they're excellent.
They're good as well.
Yeah,
right. Well, that's.
The whole Nepo Baby thing is a whole conversation that is definitely worth having. And I think there's more nuance to it than most people would want to admit. But also I think that like she's clearly put in the work, right? Like this is her first feature, but it's not her first work as an artist or as a filmmaker. She's a quite a well-regarded photographer. And I think it's only sort of like makes sense that she'd go into the family business. But like, yeah, it's definitely the Cronenbergs on the whole definitely have the eye, as it were.
And the opportunity and the resources to fulfill that creative eye, which I think is what makes me most angry about Nepo Babies, isn't actually the babies themselves, in this case, clearly very talented. It's that the greater populace just is not given financial opportunity to do stuff if they don't have people in the know, if they don't have money to go. And I think I'm more frustrated at that more than someone having built-in opportunity, particularly when they show like the quality that this film showed. So I'm very
that's the whole conversation, right? Like the nuance I'm referring to, I think, is best exemplified by someone like, say, Taylor Swift, who is clearly having a moment the last 18 months. Taylor Swift is a very talented person. She's a very talented filmmaker. She's obviously very dedicated to her craft. She works super hard. By all accounts, her tour is a huge success, not just because of, you know, the money and the stagecraft, but like she puts her all into it and she pays her people well and she does everything correct. And her parents were trust fund managers, like mutual fund managers, rich people. And so I'm not trying to ever say that Taylor Swift doesn't work hard, but she did have the resources to focus that work onto the things she wanted to do, which most 99% of the rest of us don't. And that's the conversation about Nepo. I don't think that Nepo babies are inherently bad. I think that the ones who don't acknowledge that part of their situation are bad and fooling themselves. And it happens all the time. The one that sort of shocked me was that like you get a really sort of salt of the earth sounding band like Mumford and Sons, and they sound like they are working class and they came from places, but turns out that their parents are rich, and Marcus Mumford went to a private school that costs $60,000 a year, you know, like it's a whole other podcast. So
anyway,
so that is what we're gonna
Three stars each
for two different things. And I think that's where we're going to leave it for today before we go off on too much of a rant about Nepo babies. So if you got this far, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate each and every one of you. And if you've liked what you heard, please feel free to smash that like button or give us a 5-star review or subscribe on your podcasting platform of choice. If you'd like to support us a little more directly, although those are the things that are probably the most impactful, you can do one of two ways. One of which is you can head to the homepage for this episode, and there are links powered by Just Watch, that'll tell you where you can watch the stuff we talk about. And if you click on those links, we do get a small referral commission. Also, we have a Patreon and Ko-fi, and if you subscribe to our Patreon, you get a bonus episode every week. This week we talked about horny movies from the 80s. And also David Cronenberg's filmography. And it was very interesting. If you'd like to interact with us more directly as well, we love that kind of thing. You can find me on the socials and Simon not on the socials and the show on the socials. The easiest way to find all of that is just to head to our various homepages. It's awesomefriday.ca for the show and temporarypen.com. for Simon and stretched.ca for me. And tell us what you thought about Fallout. Tell us what you thought about the family Cronenberg, and we'd love to hear it. Last but definitely not least, we are here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We're located on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish Nations. And we would like to thank you so much for joining us on this awesome Friday.